From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, sections of SB 4 are blocked, which would have allowed local police to arrest suspected illegal border crossers. And despite outcry in West Texas, the efforts to build the border wall in Big Bend country continues.
We are seeing the wholesale destruction of this incredibly special place in Texas.
This is Texas Matters. From Texas Public Radio, I'm David Martin Davies. The day before SB 4 was to take effect, a federal judge blocked key parts of the Texas law that would allow state and local police to arrest people suspected of having crossed the southern border illegally. Senate Bill 4, passed in 2023, makes the illegal crossing of the Texas-Mexico border a state crime. It also requires state magistrate judges to order those arrested for illegal entry to leave the country for Mexico if they are convicted. The Texas Civil Rights Project, the American Civil Liberties Union, and other groups argued that SB 4 is unconstitutional since immigration enforcement is solely under the jurisdiction of the federal government. They also say the law will lead to the separation of families, racial profiling, and turn police and judges into immigration agents. Kate Gibson Kumar is a staff attorney for the Beyond Borders program at the Texas Civil Rights Project.
SB 4 is a law that the Texas legislature passed in 2023 that gives the state of Texas and its law enforcement officers and state judges the ability to essentially create their own immigration law. Texas created new state crimes under SB 4 that criminalize people essentially for being immigrants. And it allows the state of Texas to issue its own removal orders and remove people without any sort of involvement from the federal government.
The law was set to go into effect basically today on Friday the 15th. What would that have done?
So I just want to clarify, part of the law has gone into effect. In our lawsuit, we challenged the illegal reentry provision, which criminalizes people who are in the state of Texas who had prior removal orders, who are found in the state of Texas again. Many of these people have pending immigration cases or they've already gotten some sort of immigration release, which is why the law conflicts so starkly with federal law. And then our lawsuit also, the injunction that we got, blocked the ability for state judges to issue their own removal orders and remove people from the state of Texas unilaterally. So what has gone into effect today is the illegal entry provision, which makes it a state crime for individuals to enter the state of Texas without inspection.
And so the part that was blocked, talk about that, because it seemed like a direct conflict with federal immigration law, that if people had been granted some state of residency or they're not undocumented immigrants, they have been given some sort of acknowledgement, but the state of Texas wanted to remove them?
Yeah. So what's incredibly incorrect and unlawful about, I mean, there's a number of things, but about the reentry provision in particular, it has no affirmative defenses to the state crime. And so theoretically, somebody who has a prior removal order in the state of Texas, this is very possible under federal immigration law for somebody to have a prior removal order and then still later be able to, you know, come back to the country and eventually get immigration status, eventually become a lawful permanent resident, and eventually become even a U.S. citizen. Having a prior removal order doesn't preclude you necessarily from all forms of immigration relief. What the reentry provision would have done if it had gone into effect today is it could have affected people with any wide variation of immigration status that could exist since there's no affirmative defense. Anybody who essentially is an immigrant who has a prior removal order, regardless of what their status would be now, would be committing a state crime just by being in the state of Texas.
So if someone had a green card, they could still be prosecuted under this law?
That's what the text of SB 4 says, that if somebody is not if they're an immigrant, even if they have a lawful permanent residency, there's no affirmative defense for having a green card under SB 4, under the reentry provision. And one of our plaintiffs in the case actually is a lawful permanent resident. And so that just goes to show how the law was written by people who don't fully have a grasp on how federal immigration law works.
Right. Another plaintiff was provisionally approved for a visa and on the path forward towards citizenship, but she was a victim of a crime. She was helping law enforcement resolve the case, and then she fell under SB4.
Yeah, so that can happen too. It can affect people in a variety of immigration cases. You know, the immigration process is a long and drawn out process. So people who have, you know, provisionally approved visas, who are still waiting to get that visa in hand, but who, you know, are following the law and working toward the process, who are doing everything right, who are getting work permits, who are, you know, in the process, the immigration process, which can take many, many years, those people who are in the process at any stage, and even up until the point when they have their lawful permanent residency, there's nothing in SB4 that says the law wouldn't apply to them. There's no affirmative defenses. And so absolutely.
Kate Gibson Kumar is a staff attorney for the Beyond Borders program at the Texas Civil Rights Project. The Trump administration is moving forward with the construction of a border wall along the Texas-Mexico border. The federal government is now looking to seize 14 acres of land on an iconic mountain outside of El Paso, which is owned by the Catholic Diocese of neighboring Las Cruces, New Mexico. The land that the federal government wants to take sits at the bottom of Mount Cristo Rey, a 720-foot-tall mountain with a 29-foot-tall statue of Jesus Christ. The Diocese of Las Cruces is resisting the government's attempt to take the land. According to the Texas Tribune, the church said in court documents, the Trump administration's efforts violates its First Amendment right to religious expression. And on Thursday, the Trump administration took action to move forward its plan for a border wall through sensitive desert lands in the Big Bend region. In March, more than 130 organizations, outfitters, and rural Texas businesses urged Congress to block federal funding for border wall construction in the Big Bend region. Lincoln Jordahl is the National Public Lands Advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity.
The administration announced they were going to waive dozens of laws in order to speed construction of border barriers along one of the most remote stretches of the entire U.S.-Mexico border. This is the area known as the Lower Canyons of the Big Bend region. It's a congressionally designated wild and scenic river. I mean, this place is truly one of the most remote, wildest stretches of river in the American Southwest.
What are they building there? What are they putting there?
Well, we don't know. You know, when you look at the CBP map, it shows a layer for what they call patrol road and vehicle barrier, which are these big steel barriers to stop vehicles, which make no sense because there's no vehicles that are crossing in this area. You cannot drive a vehicle across the border in these locations. But the waiver itself, this document that they just published in the Federal Register, it clears the way for 30-foot tall steel border walls. We have no idea what they're planning here. And that has been the thing the entire length of this project. Since we started seeing them start build walls in the Big Bend region, there's been zero transparency. We've seen this map be updated all the time and changed all the time. We cannot trust that map. But today, this document in the Federal Register actually says it clears the way for them to build border walls, not just vehicle barriers.
So this has attracted attention. There are Republicans in the area who are opposed to this border wall project because they see this as not making any sense financially, doesn't do anything for border security, and they think that this is harmful to the region. Is that correct?
100% correct. It's a total boondoggle. It makes zero sense. Immigration apprehensions are at record lows, and the Big Bend sector has the lowest number of apprehensions of anywhere along the border. So this makes a little sense anywhere, but it makes absolutely no sense along this extremely remote stretch of river, a wild and scenic river in the Lower Canyons in Big Bend.
What kind of environmental damage would happen if they actually follow through on this?
Oh, you know, if they build a road and vehicle barriers, that alone would be, you know, the largest construction project to ever occur in this extremely remote region.
We would see them likely dynamiting canyon walls in order to put roads and vehicle barriers and lighting in. If they build a physical border wall, I mean, we will see all of our wildlife in Texas on the U.S. side of the border be cut off from their main water source, which is, of course, the Rio Grande. But that means for hunters, you know, their white-tailed deer, bighorn sheep aren't going to be able to access their main source of water. You know, one of the things I'm most worried about, this waiver clears the way for them to install lighting. I mean, imagine stadium security lighting
along this incredibly remote stretch of the border. You know, this part of the world is known to have some of the darkest night skies anywhere in North America. And now we're seeing in this document that they published in the Federal Register that they want to install lighting. It's an unbelievable assault on the natural integrity of this region. And if these plans move forward, I mean, it will forever change this place.
So paint a picture for me. Like, what are we talking about here? What does this place look like?
Yeah, it's out in the middle of nowhere. But when you're down there, when you're down those canyons, I mean, you don't see any sign of human society. You can, you know, do a 7 to 10 day river trip down there and not see another person. It is one of the places that you can still find true wilderness solitude. And you're just out there with the wildlife. And all of that is at stake. You know, these areas that they're waiving laws to build roads, to build barriers, there's no roads in these places. So that means they would have to blast new roads through these areas. We've seen on some of the CDP maps that they want to build all these roads up on the Rin, which would still be extraordinarily destructive. And again, I mean, nobody is crossing the border here. So what are we doing? Why are we doing this?
Well, CPP is still moving forward with a separate plan for a 175-mile-long barrier wall in the greater Big Bend region that would stretch from Hospice County through much of Presidio County and end near Big Bend Ranch State Park. So that is also a concern?
Yeah, and we are actively suing them over that wall. They have issued a similar waiver for that stretch, which means that none of the normal environmental laws apply. That means that communities in that area are no longer protected by the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. It means that grave sites, Native American grave sites, could be blasted apart with no recourse because the tribes are no longer protected by the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Acts.
We are seeing the wholesale destruction of this incredibly special place in Texas,
all to solve a problem that doesn't exist. It just seems like
DHS is trying to find a way to spend these $46 billion because they don't have anything better to do with the money. And we wish that they would not come here and build walls in a place that they're so clearly not needed.
So how does this impact things like biodiversity in the area?
Yeah, so where we've seen border walls go up in other places, we've seen a significant decrease in genetic exchange between wildlife populations. Where walls have gone up in Arizona, we've seen large wildlife, their ability to cross the border has been reduced to virtually zero. So that means that these populations are fragmented. They're more vulnerable to disease. They can't breed. They can't find food and water sources. And the same thing that we're going to see in Big Bend when these walls go up. Additionally, this stretch of the Rio Grande Wild and Scenic River is habitat for two highly endangered mussels, the Texas horn-shell mussel and the Salina mucket. And these are species that don't have viable populations in many other places. If these populations are damaged, that could push them to the brink of extinction.
So it seems like the Trump administration they are set on building the border wall, despite that it really will have no practical impact on immigration or national security. Is there any recourse?
You know, we've already filed a lawsuit challenging the waiver that they've issued for border walls in Presidio County, Big Bend Ranch State Park, and upstream. We'll certainly be looking at our legal options for this one, but we are just urging this administration, listen to the people on the ground, listen to the sheriffs. the Republican sheriffs who have come out against this project. Listen to the river outfitters. Listen to the people who know the border in this region. And by all means, please come down to Big Bend and see this place for yourself. Because right now, the people who are pushing these plans to destroy this place, you can tell that they've never set foot in this part of the border, and they have no idea what they're getting into.
Lincoln Jordahl is the National Public Lands Advocate at the Center for Biological Diversity. 1 in 3 women in San Antonio experience intimate partner violence in their lifetime. That's according to the Collaborative Commission on Domestic Violence, which says abuse is often underreported within Latino communities because of cultural stigmas surrounding domestic violence and masculinity. Advocates say addressing the problem will require more men to confront it directly. Texas Public Radio's Ivana Bass Caldera reports on local efforts aimed at changing that culture.
During the International Women's Day march downtown, over 200 people gathered around an installation. 224 pieces of paper were strung across strings, each bearing the names of women killed in Texas last year due to gender-based violence or femicide. There were a few men at the march, and for many working to prevent intimate partner violence, that's part of the problem.
Whenever it's time to attend a gala for a domestic violence program, whenever it's time to raise money, you look around those rooms and it's almost exclusively women. And men don't necessarily see other men calling them to the table, right? Hear them, they don't see, there's no male role models out there solving for this problem.
That's Manny Belaez, an attorney and former District 8 councilman. Belaez says growing up with an abusive father shaped his decades-long work in domestic violence prevention.
We're never going to solve this problem if all we do is dedicate all of our resources and all the bandwidth and all the messaging to addressing the victim and sheltering the victim and providing excellent, and much-needed victim services without addressing the other side of the coin, which is, hey, it's dudes who are doing this, so let's talk to dudes.
Belaez says the consequences of intimate partner violence extend far beyond individual families, affecting workplaces, healthcare systems, and society as a whole.
This literally has a really terrible impact on the economy, right? I mean, when 1 in 3 women are being impacted this way, that means that their job stability is impacted, their healthcare costs go up, and that ripple effect has a huge impact on labor, on insurance rates, on employment rates, all that, right?
Belaez says many men still avoid talking about intimate partner violence because the subject is difficult and uncomfortable. Ramon Vasquez is the founder of the San Antonio Fatherhood Campaign, an initiative dedicated to helping men and fathers improve their self-esteem and learn to engage in healthy relationships. Vasquez explains why people avoid talking about abuse.
Intimate partner violence, violence against children, those are the dirty little secrets that our families hold. And, you know, you're talking about having families be okay letting that go. Because as long as we keep it, our dirty little secrets, it makes it hard.
Vasquez says domestic violence is not unique to the Latino community. It's a public health issue that occurs in all ethnic groups. Because of the large Latino population in San Antonio, the campaign works closely with students to redefine machismo, the Latino cultural construct of exaggerated masculinity. Vasquez says that to redefine machismo, the program teaches guys about the difference between maleness versus manhood.
Manhood is about responsibility. It's about accountability. It's about being someone of your word. Do people believe what you say when you say you're going to do something? Being a person of character, taking responsibility for your children, your spouse, your community. When you do something wrong, do you stand and be accountable for your actions?
The campaign's program director, Greg Marshall, says that there is power in calling out each other's unhealthy behaviors.
Then we look at them and say, by the way, I see you. When you're talking to your wife or the mother of your children, it's good when we use her name. I seen you talking to Samantha, right? Because that's a person. You know, if that was your daughter, how would you feel to see a man talking that way to your daughter? And we connect them to that moment. We might not be better all the time, But if I could be a little bit better today and a little bit better tomorrow, that helps, right?
The program teaches that abusive behavior is often rooted in power and control.
That means I need to take control of you for me to be feel better. And if I can fix you, my world will be better. But that's not the answer, because I'm still miserable inside. Until I start taking ownership for that, until I start realizing that I'm responsible for my thoughts, my feelings, my behaviors. Until that happens, I'm still gonna be miserable.
Since 2004, the San Antonio Fatherhood Campaign says it has helped more than 10,000 men and fathers in the community. The campaign is one of several local organizations working to involve men in preventing domestic violence. Others include the Peace Initiative, the Bexar County Family Justice Center, and Family Violence Prevention Services, led by CEO Marta Prada Pelaez, Manny Pelaez's mother. Pelaez says those efforts could be strengthened by more men being willing to talk to one another about abuse.
Men are also, like women, we're all a little bit allergic to being lectured to, right? I think it's important for men to remember that it's okay to be your brother's keeper.
Belaya says he plans on spending the rest of his life recruiting men to start these conversations. I'm Ivana Vascalera in San Antonio.
As the price of oil rises, so does the problem of oil wrestling. That's the theft of crude oil, a crime that's been part of the Texas oil patch since the earliest days of wildcatters. But today, officials say oil field theft has grown into something more organized, more dangerous, and more costly. In March of 2025, an oil pipeline exploded in the night sky over Reeves County in West Texas. Investigators said it was the result of oil thieves trying to tap into a pressurized pipeline.
They cut into the pipeline and tried to tap directly into the main pipeline.
That's Tim Murphy with the Texas Department of Public Safety, testifying recently before the Texas House Energy Resources Committee.
It sparked and it blew. They blew up everything in the area, but the pipeline burned for several days.
Murphy said this was an example of oil field theft that went horribly wrong, but it could have been much worse. The massive fire was contained before it reached a more populated area. Officials say the incident shows how oil field theft has become more than a property crime. It is a serious threat to workers, nearby communities, and critical energy infrastructure. And in West Texas, virtually anywhere you look is critical energy infrastructure. The Permian Basin provides about half of the nation's oil. The vast, flat, dusty landscape is populated with pump jacks, oil storage tanks, and drilling pads. Each one is a tempting target for a thief.
It's like any other commodity. When the price is high, they just get sexier.
That's Jim Wright, chairman of the Texas Railroad Commission, the state agency that oversees oil and gas production. Wright says the thieves are often sophisticated.
They're cloning these trucks. They can take a truck and get a full load of oil and not be noticed.
Wright says criminals paint tanker trucks to look like legitimate oil field service vehicles.
So as they go through these remote ranches to get access to that oil, they go unnoticed.
The stolen crude is sold through a broker who sells it onto the market. He says the theft is happening across Texas.
About 40% of the industry has experienced some sort of theft. And so I've heard that number could be as high as $1 billion on an annual basis.
Wright says the problem is growing, and recent criminal cases show the scale. In April, federal prosecutors announced that 14 people from Texas and New Mexico had been indicted in an alleged crude oil theft conspiracy. The indictment alleges crude oil was siphoned from producers in southeastern New Mexico and then transported across state lines into Texas for resale. Sheriff Stan Parker of Howard County in West Texas says he doesn't have the manpower to deal with the problem.
Our county alone gets probably over 1,000, 1,500 barrels of oil reported stolen every month.
Parker says the oil thieves know the oil drilling business, and law enforcement does not.
Our problem is we don't know who's supposed to be there and who's not. And the thing about it is if I pulled up on a tank battery right now, I don't know if you can be there or you not. I don't know if you're drawing water off of it. I don't know if you're pulling oil. It's got very complicated.
Texas lawmakers have responded by creating an organized oil field theft prevention unit within the Department of Public Safety, which is now training local sheriffs what to look for to spot an oil thief. The legislature also created the Stop Theft Task Force to study petroleum theft gaps in the law and long-term economic impacts. The task force will report its findings to state lawmakers in December. Texas has recently increased the criminal penalty for oil field theft. Depending on the value of what was stolen, a conviction can carry 2 to 10 years or up to life in prison. Texas is the nation's second largest crawfish producer, behind Louisiana. Despite a slow start to crawfish season this year due to a late freeze, Texas farmers brought in a plentiful harvest, as the state has had its warmest winter on record since 1895. Houston Public Media's Natalie Weber tells us these warmer winters have caused a shift in when crawfish farmers begin their season.
Wearing a camouflage wetsuit, long rubber boots, and a baseball cap, Christian Burden steers his fishing boat into a rice field in Anahuac, about an hour east of Houston. He's working for his cousin, who owns a crawfish farm here. Burns is harvesting roughly 20 sacks of crawfish daily, enough to feed up to 200 people. He says the harvest in any given year really depends on the weather.
Warmer weather means we're able to catch more crawfish just because they're more active. Once the water gets below 50, they don't really do a whole lot of moving around and feeding.
As Burns fishes, he dumps the mud bugs, or crawfish, into a tray on his boat. Once it's full, he scrapes the red crustaceans into large mesh sacks. While some of the crawfish will go to a restaurant on the farm, the rest will be sold and cooked at seafood boils and businesses across Texas.
Okay, so these are our boilers, okay? They're custom-made, stainless steel in Louisiana.
Dominic Mandola is the owner of the Raging Cajun restaurant in Houston. He says crawfish season has been plentiful this year. That's due in part to the warmer weather. When there's a freeze, he says that slows down the harvest.
There's been some times where we've ran out of crawfish on Fat Tuesday throughout the last 50 years because of the freeze.
But while milder winters can help kickstart crawfish season, hotter summers can hurt the harvest. That's what happened 2 years ago. After triple-digit temperatures in the summer and a drought, killed off crawfish before the winter fishing season. Mandola says that was unusual. Warmer winters are becoming more common in Texas, according to Assistant State Climatologist B.J. Bowley.
Texas winter temperatures have generally been warming up over time, over the last several decades, particularly since about the 1980s.
Nikki Fitzgerald is a coastal and marine county resources agent with Texas A&M AgriLife. She says as Texas winters have gotten warmer, she's seen a shift in when crawfish season begins.
Now you're starting to see crawfish in December and January. In the early 90s and stuff, crawfish season typically would start at the beginning of March. And as people have really started enjoying crawfish, it's, you know, the warmer seasons have actually encouraged the fishermen to get out quicker.
Back in East Texas, Christian Burns says there were only 3 months over the last year where his cousin's farm didn't harvest any crawfish.
We're working on building more fields, so we're ever expanding.
And as the farm grows, he says they're getting closer to figuring out how to fish year-round. I'm Nedley Weber in Houston.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can find Texas Matters wherever you download cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.